Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. It's Lexington's 250th birthday, and we're celebrating all year long with the stories of individuals from all walks of life who have in some way influenced the history of the city. Later in the hour, we go all the way from the Lexington slave trade to the life of a Confederate senator. And we have the latest in our series of listener questions about dog and cat behavior. First, though, Carolyn DuPont, who wears many hats as an EKU historian, a state coordinator for Braver Angels, that's a group that facilitates civil red-blue discussion, and a contributing interviewer here at Eastern Standard. And this week, her focus is on these times that we're all living through, our bandwidths stretched to the limit, our patience with those who see things differently stretched thin.
I'm speaking today with Monica Guzman. Guzman is the Senior Fellow for Public Practice at Braver Angels and author of I Never Thought of It That Way, How to Have Fearlessly Curious Conversations in Dangerously Divided Times. She's the co-founder of The Evergrey, a former columnist at the Seattle Times, a recent fellow at Harvard's Nieman Foundation for Journalism and the Henry M. Jackson Foundation, an immigrant, a dual U.S.-Mexico citizen, and the mom of two bilingual kids. So thank you so much, Monica, for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for mentioning my kids. That's very awesome.
Well, I'm a mom, and I like it when people mention my kids. So, you write a lot about curiosity. And I just wanted to ask, why is curiosity, rather than judgment, lecturing, ranting, sending articles, why is that the answer to what's ailing us right now as a country?
Oh, for several reasons, one of which is we are so divided, we're blinded. We're siloed in such different communities of thought and interaction and conversation that it's difficult to see from high enough to see what the debates truly are, and instead we'll see what we project them to be because we're not close enough to see. The other reason curiosity is so important right now is we all want to matter and we all want to be heard. And when someone is really, truly, generously curious about what someone else thinks and is willing to listen long enough to understand what that other person thinks, it's kind of a gift that we don't give each other enough. And when we do, doors open in our minds and everywhere else.
Yeah, I love all of that. There's a great David Brooks book recently in which he says that we underestimate how much people are craving to be asked about who they really are. So why is curiosity so hard? Why is that not the first instinct in conversations where there's disagreement?
Well, for one, we're terrified of being wrong. We're really afraid of the judgment of folks on our own side. We're afraid of, you know, the groups to whom we feel we belong. What will they think if I ask this question at this moment? Maybe they'll suspect me. There's a lot of that. It's also hard because we really want to win. And whenever we are in that showdown moment with someone who disagrees with us, sometimes that instinct takes over. We're having the conversation to prove something, not to learn something. And maybe the other person adopts the same kind of posture. And before you know it, you're not really exploring perspectives or engaging in a collective search for truth at the intersection of your perspectives. You're just trying to prove who's better. And once that takes over, curiosity becomes very difficult if it isn't in the service of sabotage, manipulation, cornering the person out, right? And those tend to be some of the conversations that we regret the most later.
Yeah, I think we've all had those.
Mm-hmm.
I hear a lot, I'm sure you do too, that the problem is misinformation. And it is true that conversations across the political divide do break down because we're not sharing the same set of facts. But you say that getting rid of misinformation is not the answer. So can you say more about that?
Yeah. So obviously, we don't want to live in a world where falsehoods travel as far as they do in today's world. So I'm not saying let's just allow that. Let's just accept that. What I am saying, though, is that there's something underneath truth. There's a prerequisite for the collective search for truth that is productive in a democratic republic, and that is trust. So too often we use the idea of misinformation. That person believes something I believe to be false and the product of misinformation. Therefore, I can learn nothing from them. They are now disqualified from having any bearing on my understanding of the world. But we miss a lot when we do that. Because as I often say, even if someone's conclusions are false, their stories are true. There's something in their stories always that is true. And when we're able to see underneath those disagreements about facts to the shared values that we do all have, to the concerns that animate what we want to believe, and sometimes we make ourselves believe something that doesn't have a lot of evidence behind it. Okay. But what is powering that desire to believe that thing that may not have a lot of evidence behind it? It's some deep concern. Talk about that. You can always talk about that.
So I know that so much of your approach is born out of your experience as the daughter of Mexican immigrants who voted for Trump, and you are an open liberal. And so could you just say a little bit, I know this is a much larger story, but how has that informed your journey on this?
In every way. I wouldn't have written the book. I would not have joined Braver Angels. I wouldn't have done any of the things that I've been obsessing over the last 8 years, really, if not for the fact that I am in a politically divided family and that somehow we have been able to have really difficult, sometimes painful conversations. You will hear us yelling. You will hear us breaking all the rules in my book, right? Because that's part of it. These things are messy. Rupture and repair, rupture and repair. But what you will also hear is us understanding things we didn't previously understand about the other person's point of view. So thanks to my parents, and since my parents, a lot of other folks who are on the other side of the political divide from me, the conversations we've had, oh my goodness, I understand a lot of things I didn't previously understand. The world is less scary to me as a liberal who is now in the political minority, right? It's a lot less scary to me. I don't see the monsters I used to see around every corner because, you know, you get close enough to people and you really look for who they are, you know, not just looking for them to justify this horrible thing I think you think. And you realize that for the most part, it is still very much true that we're all trying our best here. And there are some very divergent ideas. And there are, let's remember, conflict entrepreneurs out there exacerbating our divisions and profiting from our rage. And I'll tell you, one of the places I find hope is the fact that across the political divide, we can all agree on at least that the way we talk to each other is broken. So let's fix it.
Mm-hmm. You said you don't see the monsters and you don't feel as fearful, but I think that liberals, and I'm one as well, you know, we in the last many weeks have been, some of us have been feeling more fearful. And when I talk about Braver Angels and the mission of Braver Angels and talking to people across the divide, I get skepticism from both sides. I know you do as well. And, you know, sometimes the skepticism sounds something like this. So, you know, this all sounds really kumbaya. It sounds really Pollyannish. And we've got powerful people doing real harm. And, you know, it feels to me like a betrayal to put aside what I believe and the harm that I think is happening and to try to understand people who support this. And so, what do you say in that case?
I mean, there's a lot of places to jump in there. I think one thing is this idea that I have to put aside what I believe in order to understand someone else. That is not true. The project of building understanding and building these, you know, bridges between us across differences is not about being nice. It's not about coming to the middle. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's not what it is. This is about making it so that we can be heard at all. by others who disagree. And the only way you can do that is to demonstrate receptiveness to other ideas. At Braver Angels, we teach this technique called the pivot. You have spent a couple minutes even, that's all it takes, a couple minutes listening generously and non-judgmentally to someone else about their point of view. Then you do the pivot. You first say something like, okay, so if I understand you right, you're concerned about abortion because of this. Did I get that right? The other person goes, yeah. And then you say, I see it differently. Can I tell you what I mean? And if you have given them the gift of your non-judgmental attention and reception, then they almost always give it back to you. Mm-hmm. So this is not about, I'm going to set aside what I believe. This is about, I am going to open a channel of communication, demonstrate the trust and receptiveness it takes to even have that channel not backfire on us. And once that channel is open, I can understand them and they can finally hear and understand me. And that's what we want. That's what we need in our society. Right now, basically any other way we think we're going to, what, open that channel by force? We're going to shame people into listening to us? Really? That doesn't work. We know that doesn't work. So we got to stop doing what doesn't work.
And bombarding them with better facts doesn't work either,
no,
does it?
No. All that does, first of all, like, okay, better facts, who gets to decide? You know, let's be humble. But also, that's just condescension. Why would I listen to someone who thinks I'm stupid? Why would I do that? None of us would do that.
I've got one more question. It's a really vulnerable question. But I will say that in the last recent weeks, I've found it harder to live up to the ideals that I have embraced as a person who's been involved with Braver Angels for 4 or 5 years. And I'm just curious, have you found it harder? And if so, how are you thinking about your mission and the mission of Braver Angels at this particular moment? And maybe you're so good at this that nothing's changed for you.
I know. I can't tell you how much I want to tell you that I have found it harder so that you and your listeners really relate to me, because I know how that works. If people don't see that, they start to think that person is some kind of weirdo. I have nothing like her. It doesn't make any sense. The truth is that I've not found it harder. I have found myself recommitting, because to me, some of the worst instincts we see in our politics, reactionary, reckless acts, aggression, that's a symptom of, that is a direct consequence of a society that prefers to fight than talk, that is more afraid of approaching somebody different with empathy than they are of approaching them with rhetorical grenades. This is where we are. This is the kind of politics we get when we do this. So I don't want that kind of politics. And by the way, I've seen that kind of politics on both sides, but where we are as a country really calls us to model something better at the grassroots and with each other so that our politicians and our media get this signal from us that we've had enough and we can't demand better from them when we can't do better ourselves.
Yeah, so I hear you saying this is coming from us. There is an element that comes from the top, but there's also an element that comes from us.
Absolutely, and it is in both places. The grassroots is not sufficient, you know? Like, the way we talk to each other over the kitchen table is necessary but not sufficient. We need institutions. We need the people within those institutions, politics and media in particular, to be brave enough to stand up to the incentives in those institutions that are freezing them in this horrible polarizing dysfunction. And I do see lots of those brave voices and souls and hearts everywhere, but they need more of our support, yo.
They don't provide the clickbait.
Right. They're afraid they'll be voted out. They're afraid their news organization won't be able to get the clicks they need. These are the things. We have systems in place. Everything, it's a machine. It's a machine to get our dopamine levels up and all of this. And we know it. We feel it. We see it. And it's so much easier to say someone else has to fix it first. But we can't say that. This is all hands on deck.
Monica Guzman, thank you so much for this conversation, and thank you for the work you do. And we will link to I Never Thought of It That Way on our page. And thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up after the break. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU has teamed up with NPR and stations in Kentucky, Tennessee, and West Virginia to form the Appalachian and Mid-South Newsroom. This special collaboration will provide news about the issues that matter the most in our communities. Listen for stories from the Appalachian and Mid-South Newsroom on NPR at WEKU. The WEKU app is redesigned and totally updated. We've made it easier to play the live streams of WEKU and WEKU Classical. You can also find WEKU podcasts and NPR podcasts all in one place. There's more information on what's playing on WEKU Classical. The updated WEKU app is available in the Apple App Store and on Google Play.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. In the context of human history, 250 years, it's a blink. But so much can happen in 250 years. For example, Lexington, Kentucky can happen. Founded in 1775, the city this year celebrates 2.5 centuries of existence. And in that time, in the history of Lexington, you will find an abundance of the good, the bad, and the ugly. Our guest is University of Kentucky History Professor Gerald Smith. Dr. Smith hosts an Eastern Standard series on racial justice and equality. He is the editor of Slavery and Freedom in the Bluegrass State, Revisiting My Old Kentucky Home, a compilation of chapters by 11 contributing writers, and he joins us to help us explore its pages. Gerald Smith, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us what motivated you to organize this kind of book.
I'd been teaching Kentucky African American history. It was a course I developed at UK for about 15 years. And so in 2020, I decided that I wanted to put together a collection of essays. I had done something similar for the Kentucky Historical Society in 2011, where I was a special guest editor of the Kentucky Register. And I decided to go full scale in 2020 and reached out to several scholars to find out what kind of work that they were doing. And I already knew what I wanted the book to look like in terms of themes dealing with freedom and citizenship and identity and violence and public memory. And so just, you know, trying to put all the pieces together because I wanted to have a book that my students could use that wouldn't necessarily be a textbook. I'm in the process of writing a new general history of Blacks in Kentucky literally at this moment. So I thought it would be just a very perfect fit for the class.
Okay. Slavery and Freedom in the Bluegrass State, Revisiting My Old Kentucky Home. That title, how did you land on that?
For a number of years, I was the chair of the Kentucky African American Heritage Commission, but I was also working on the Kentucky African American Encyclopedia as one of the co-editors with that volume. That book came out in 2015. And so myself, along with my co-editors, John Harden and Karen McDaniel, we would visit, you know, throughout the state. We'd go to different county libraries and so forth. And on one occasion, myself, along with one of the undergraduate research assistants, we visited Bardstown. And I got there. The presentation was like at 6 o'clock. We got there early. I suggested to him, I said, listen, you know, my old Kentucky home's just right down the street. I've never been there before. What do you say we drop in and, you know, just be tourists for an hour or so? That's what we did. And so, of course, like many people, you know, I have been in a program or attended a program that's dealt with, maybe it's some sort of assembly or athletic program, heard the song many times, but I've never been to the site. So go to the site and go through the tour. You know, I observed during the tour that the docent was really not talking about the African-American experience. And I was asking questions. And one of the questions that I asked about was, where are the enslaved people buried? I see a cemetery in the front. Well, that's where the Rowan family were buried. And she told me, she said, oh, you know, they're in the back, way in the back. They weren't a part of the tour. And so I went back there, and I talk about all that in the introduction of the book, to sort of how I set up the book and the reason for the title and so forth. And so I titled it Revisiting, you know, going back, taking another look at my old Kentucky home, looking at the song and looking at the site. And for me, I was revisiting it. I had heard the song many times. I was familiar with the lyrics, But this time I'm going back, and not only am I going back, but I want the readers to go back with me and re-examine and really reevaluate our understanding of the Kentucky African-American experience, especially through the lens of Black people.
Well, you really grab the reader's attention with the very first chapter by Brandon Wilson. I think it's titled 149 North Broadway. Tell us about that title.
As I was working with the contributors, I let them know, obviously, the title and what I was trying to do, the dots we were trying to connect, and so that there would be a theme throughout the book that sort of focused on the behind-the-scene experiences of African-Americans. And so I think Brandon Wilson did a great job in terms of setting that up. As he talked about this Pullman Slave Jail, which was located not too far from Rupp Arena, where there was a UK player, Dante Allen, you know, who was on the team, who had connections with one of the persons from his family, one of his ancestors, who had been enslaved in that particular jail. And sort of setting that up in terms of, on the one hand, I thought he did a great job in terms of the singing of my old Kentucky home at Rupp Arena, but then looking at what's happening to an enslaved woman just a block or so down the street.
He also described something that sounds absolutely dystopian when we talk about it today, and it would be unimaginable today, but it was routine in the times. Coffles of men and women chained in irons marched past places of business as a matter of routine. Why is it important to recall that today in 2025?
Well, you know, I think because he also goes on in that chapter to make it clear that many of these slave jails sort of blended in to the regular housing in that community. Mm-hmm. But marching them down through the street was a reminder, one, for enslaved Black men and women, as well as free Black men and women, of who was in charge, who had the power. These were people who were being oppressed, that they were being oppressed, that we have the power to do what we need to do, to remind you of your place. But it also was a way of empowering white citizens in terms of them knowing that the law was on their side, you know, knowing that they were still policing the community. And so it was a means of intimidation. It also was an expression of pain as well as power, of human beings as well as human capital. And so it was so ingrained, and I think Brandon does a great job with this in terms of it being a part of what was considered to be the normal local community's economy, but not only the local economy, but the state as well as the national and global economy. Mm-hmm. So it was another means of a profit and opportunity.
These residences that were actually jails were all pretty much in a general area that surrounded what was a major market, slave market. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. When I was working on the Lexington book that came out in 2002, Black America series, Lexington, Kentucky, those photographs, you know, I visited a number of different archives, and those photographs I actually found at Transylvania University, and as well as the library from different collections. And so, you know, we had, you know, J. Winston Coleman, for example, noted, you know, photographer, historian, landowner here in Lexington. He had taken some photographs. Another gentleman, the Bullock collection, the Bastille collection. Going through those collections, I was able to find images of those slave jails in that existed pre-1865.
Well, as I mentioned, there are 11 contributors to the book, and each chapter riveting, interesting, but I'm kind of focusing on the first chapter, Brandon Wilson, because he goes on to remark about, in his words, the tragic continuities from this crucial history in the physical and social structures that shape our contemporary world today. Mm-hmm. What do those continuities look like now in 2025?
You know, we were all writing around 2021, 2022. The book came out in 2023. And so, you know, this was all within the context of the killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, you know, just in terms of a policing and incarceration and the continuation of the kind of policing and incarceration that the African-American community is experiencing and witnessing, you know, tragically. And it was just as very much as tragic, you know, pre-1865 as it was in the 2000s.
Mm-hmm. Your fellow historian, James Clotter, notes on the back of the book that the African-American experience has been woefully ignored, and he credits you with working to change that narrative, as we've heard that you have been doing and are continuing to do. What does the book reveal, though, about Kentucky history that has not been disclosed?
I think, having taught Kentucky African-American experience for a number of years to undergraduate students, as well as my own research and writing. I first started writing about Blacks in Lexington, believe it or not, in 1979, for an undergraduate paper. I did an oral history paper on a man who, Reverend Henry Wise Jones, who was in the civil rights movement in Lexington. And so my master's thesis was on the civil rights movement in Lexington. I want to finish my MA in 1983. And so, thinking about all of that and getting to this point in my career, and knowing what has been published and, wanting to make a difference, to get us thinking about some new topics, I wanted to address the sights, the sounds, the stories that have been long forgotten, to really go behind the scenes in the African-American community. So I wanted to center Black people in Kentucky. What's going on in African-American homes? And so there's a chapter in there, outstanding chapter by Charlene Fletcher. She looks at domestic violence and domestic labor in the home. There's a chapter dealing with religion that focuses on the Shakers, the Shaker Village. Well, at Pleasant Hill in Mercer County. Well, that was home for not only white Shakers, but Black Shakers as well. But also to get a sense of, even though the Shakers tried to create a more independent community, one that was open to anyone, man, women, Black, white, how the Shakers could not release themselves from the tentacles of slavery, because, no matter where you look, the slave economy was present. So there was no complete independence from slavery. I have a chapter in there where I talk about give us something to yell for. I'll focus on the University of Kentucky's recruitment of Black athletes in the 1960s and how Reggie Warford, who was the second Black player to sign on the UK basketball team, refused to stand with the playing of my old Kentucky home. And so throughout the book, there's this, this reference back to home and what Black people are doing in their own homes and for their own homes and for their families and for their marriages and so forth.
There is also a chapter that talks about the years immediately following emancipation and how slaveholders were trying to recoup their losses. I think at one point it was written that there were almost as many cases before the Kentucky Court of Appeals as those before the Tennessee Supreme Court, which had more cases than any other state in the South, of these former slaveholders who are now trying to find some way to recoup their losses. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, that chapter, it's by Juliana Perrone. It's titled Unfinished Freedom, The Legal History of Reconstruction in Kentucky. What she does in that particular chapter is focus on how the state of Kentucky was so resistant to the 13th Amendment, and when, in other words, the emancipation of Black people, that even though slavery had ended by law, the fundamental foundations of slavery, the arguments for slavery, remained in place, and they were carried out through the judicial system. And so she writes about the Kentucky Court of Appeals, looking at cases, whether it's dealing with debt, whether it's dealing with marriage, whether it's dealing with contracts, tended to side with former enslavers. In other words, if an enslaver had made a contract with another white person, if they had hired out one of their slaves, and now slavery is over with, will that person still be required to fulfill the contract that was made prior to the ending of slavery? And the Kentucky Court of Appeals would support the fact that, yes, even though slavery has ended by law, the economic foundations and the obligations, responsibilities that carried forth during the period of slavery can carry forth after the period of slavery. Just in terms of marriage, for example, because marriage was important, especially for those men who had served in the Civil War. And Kentucky remained in the Union during the war, but politicians and others were very much upset with the presence of the federal government, particularly the Freedmen's Bureau in the state of Kentucky. And so those Black men who had served in the Civil War, their spouses and their children were deserving of benefits of soldiers who had served in the war. And so just how trying to recoup the kind of financial obligations that the government had made prior to the ending of the war, that they would be fulfilled after the war, then we would find Kentucky being very resistant to supporting Black veterans, even in that regard. And so it was just a constant struggle. We often say, well, slavery ended in 1865, just in that particular chapter of Black people's life, notwithstanding, you know, the whippings, the beatings, the lynchings, the discrimination, and all the other. Just when it came to, you know, dealing with the judicial system, period, we see this continuation of slavery. Because Kentucky didn't necessarily have to abide by the Black codes that came after the Civil War and so forth.
Just wasn't neat and clean, was it? It was not as though emancipation, the curtain lifted and everybody is free. And it was extremely complicated.
And there it is. I mean, I think what it demonstrates is the complexity of the years immediately following the end of the Civil War. And so how are all these details going to be worked out? And in the midst of all of this, it's the Black people who are struggling for survival. They're struggling for safety, struggling for trying to get housing and get education and get decent wages, to own property, and at the same time being regulated to live in certain parts of the cities and the least desirable areas of cities. So it was a constant uphill battle. And that's what her essay does.
Well, it's really important work, and it brings context to where we are now as we're talking about Lexington's 250 years of existence, and to understand the difficult nuances that this city has experienced and grown through. And we appreciate your work for this. Dr. Gerald Smith, professor of history at the University of Kentucky. He is a contributing interviewer for Eastern Standard and editor of Slavery and Freedom in the Bluegrass State, Revisiting My Old Kentucky Home. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
George Graham Vest was once described by the chief clerk of the U.S. Senate as one of the most remarkable and picturesque men this country has produced. His remarkable and original genius, his conspicuously independent intellect, his absolute fearlessness have placed him peculiarly in a class by himself. It doesn't end there, but before we get ahead of ourselves with the story of this man who's credited with coining the phrases, "Dog is man's best friend," and "History is written by the victors," let's bring in a living modern-day Vest, Stephen M. Vest, author of George Graham Vest, The Life and Times of Dog's Best Friend. You may also know Steve as publisher of Kentucky Monthly. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Steve.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I take it that this remarkable man that you describe in your book, George Graham Vest, is an ancestor?
Well, he's a relative. I think he's my third cousin, four times removed, if I'm correct. I was interested in him because we share the same last name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as the family connection, when I first started doing the research, I had no idea how we were really connected. He was not somebody that I grew up hearing a lot about or knowing much about. But when we started Kentucky Monthly, our offices were located in Frankfort, right around the corner from the Vest Lindsay House, which is where he grew up and where he lived until he was 23. And I always kind of wondered because he vaguely does look a little bit like my father. And I thought, well, there has to be a connection somewhere. But mm-hmm. Yeah, he's not really an ancestor, but he is a relative.
Now, Vest's father was responsible for building some of Frankfurt's most historic buildings. Tell us about that.
Well, he was one of the builders on the what we call the old state capitol, which is the Gideon Shyrock building downtown. He also built the Franklin County Courthouse. He built the Arsenal, which is now the Kentucky Military History Museum. And he built the Kentucky Military Institute, which is now known as the Stuart Holman School. He was a part of all of those. And then he built the Federal-style house that his family lived in. It became more of a boarding house. At the time that Vest lived there in the 1850 census, I think there were 20-something people living in the house. Most of his family, but then some boarders as well.
So has this story about this man been something that's kind of buzzed around in your family for some time?
For the last 30 years, anyway. Uh-huh. I started writing the book, actually, about 34 years ago. It was before my son was born, and then I shelved it and put it away, and then started on it again and put it away, as you do when you're, you know, raising four kids. 2 years ago, my daughter finally graduated from college and left home, and, you know, I'm an empty nester, and I pulled out all the notes, and I was further along than I thought, but I made a couple of trips to Missouri to make sure that I wasn't overlooking anything before I really started working on the book portion of it. And I spent about a year and a half working on the book, and then it came out this past October.
And why Missouri?
Well, he left Kentucky. He was going west to find his fortune somewhere. Supposedly, he was headed for San Jose. He had a buggy accident in Missouri, found himself surrounded by Kentuckians who had also left Kentucky and ended up in Missouri. And he ended up staying in Missouri, and he was an attorney there. He was a state legislator there. He went on to become a Confederate congressman, Confederate senator, then went back into the law practice, and then eventually was a 24-year United States senator from Missouri.
Well, it's obvious from the book that you did a ton of research. Mm-hmm. And I know before we began the interview, we were talking about this, and you mentioned, speaking of a Confederate Senate, Kentucky's role in that Senate, and in particular Lexington's role in that Senate.
Well, in the Senate and in Jefferson Davis's cabinet, most of them were Transy people that Jefferson Davis had known from Transy in his days there. Very much the same as Vest was surrounded by Kentuckians through most of his life. Wherever he happened to be, he found himself around people he had known in Lexington or Frankfort or Danville. He had gone to school in Frankfort as a young man. Actually went to Center College as they classified him as a junior coming in. So he only spent 2 years in Danville and then went to law school at Transy. Decided he really didn't like it. He went to Owensboro, started a newspaper. Decided there was no money in print media long before anybody else
figured
that out.
I was going to say, he was way ahead of his time.
Yeah, and then he decided, okay, I think I should go back to law school. He did. He was the valedictorian in his class, which included John Marshall Harlan, who went on to become a Supreme Court justice, and at least one other Supreme Court clerk that was in his class, but he was the valedictorian.
You write that Vest's youth could have easily served as inspiration for Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer.
Mm-hmm.
How come?
Well, his humor is similar. They're contemporaries, and you know, he tells some pretty tall tales. One of my favorite ones is that he and a friend, Charlie, were going to go on a pigeon hunt up in Owen County, and they were going to go on an early Saturday morning, and it rained. So they cut Sunday school the next day and went on this pigeon hunt. You know, they basically stole the horse and carriage and some ammunition and some guns, and where they were going on this great big pigeon hunt that turned into a major accident when they tried to hide the cigars in the wrong place and the powder all blew up and terrified the horses and everything else. And it's one of my favorite stories in the book, but it reads like something right out of Twain. You know, one thing leads to another, which leads to another, which leads to another.
Well, during this process of discovery that you went through, were there any big surprises?
Well, I didn't know how much he was involved in the creation of Yellowstone Park. That was a big one to me. It's another kind of Twainian story in that he was in the Dakotas. He was on his way back from Yellowstone, and he was staying in a hotel, and some New York land speculators and business interests happened to be at the next table. They didn't recognize him as being a United States senator. And so they were talking about all their schemes about how they were going to carve up the park and, you know, they were going to get all this rail access and basically turn it into a resort. You know, much like we hear on the TV show Yellowstone even today. And he sat there and listened to everything they had to say. And then was able to go back to Washington and undo all of the deals that they had made and pretty much save the park. And then anytime legislation came up trying to do anything that might threaten the park in the future, he was there. And he fought it from the 1800s all the way through 1904 when he died. And much of what we have of Yellowstone today is due in part to Vest.
Back in the introduction, I touched on some vest characteristics that moved the chief clerk of the U.S. Senate to describe someone almost superhuman. It almost sounded like friend and fishing buddy of presidents, Supreme Court justices, and even the world's most famous bank and train robbers.
Yes.
Attended the first Sunday school west of the Alleghenies, and the only legislator in American history to be assaulted by a woman during an open legislative session.
Yes.
That's a lot to process. Why isn't George Graham vest as widely known as, say, Henry Clay or Daniel Boone?
Well, because, for one, he was on the wrong side most of the time. Hmm. He was in a minority most of the time. Most of the things, other than Yellowstone, that he really pushed for never passed. And, you know, he did. He found himself again and again on the losing side of many things. And, you know, there's one scene in the book where he and another Confederate, former Confederate who went on to the United States Senate, are in a carriage riding down the streets of Washington, and they're talking about how unlikely it is that they would be in the positions they are, you know, in this beautiful city, and at the time in this beautiful carriage on these beautiful streets in the capital of a country that they did spend 4 years trying to overthrow. And, you know, many people said that if he hadn't have been a Confederate for those 4 years, that he probably would have been either a Supreme Court justice or possibly something even higher than himself. But in Missouri, you know, his past, it was not held against him because everybody shared that same past. And so he was able to do some good, and he tried to do good, it seemed to me, in most of the opportunities he had. But, yeah, he did. He spent a lot of time on the wrong side of history.
Well, I think it's a fair bet that we have at least one listener out there that's saying, would you please go back to what you just said?
Mm-hmm.
The only legislator in American history to be assaulted by a woman during an open legislative session.
Yes.
What was that about?
Well, there was he and a she doesn't name him by name. There was another senator from Georgia that she claimed besmirched her reputation. She came into court. She went to the stand. She stated her case, and then she took a bullwhip to George Van Vest and beat him with it. She said the other guy was so despicable that he didn't even deserve her wrath, and then stormed out of the building. And then dispatches were sent to all of the newspapers that covered the Confederate Congress saying that she must have been suffering from some kind of ration madness, and for everybody to please disregard anything that the woman said. At least one senator from North Carolina wrote down most of what she said, which is also in the book. But basically, she said that he had said something or done something that made her look bad, and she wasn't going to take it anymore.
Well, now, you mentioned earlier that his childhood home in Frankfort is known today as the Vest Lindsay House.
Yes.
Is the house preserved as a historic site? It can be toured?
By appointment, because I was in it back when the book came out. It's part of the historic properties of downtown Frankfort, the state properties. It's right next to the Paul Sawyer Library. It's across from the Justice Todd House and in an area that is called the Corner of Celebrities, because there were many famous people, at least at that time, that came from that block.
Well, let's talk more about those sayings. Dog is man's best friend, and history is written by the victors. What are the contexts? What inspired those?
Well, in Dog is Man's Best Friend, he never actually said exactly dog is man's best friend. He was hired to give a closing argument in a Missouri Supreme Court case where one neighbor had killed the other neighbor's dog, and they had sued each other at various levels all the way up to the Missouri Supreme Court. And the two attorneys, well, actually the two attorneys on either side of the case, were people that George had gone to Transy Law School with, and they knew how great an orator he was. And they needed a closing argument because the side that was prosecuting the guy for killing the dog felt like they might lose. And they knew that George could deliver pretty much any topic, any time. So they asked him to come in and talk about dogs. And so he came in, he gave a speech, you know, basically sums up that, you know, you can raise your children with loving care and they may prove ungrateful. You may have all kinds of money, but when you need it most, it's gone. You know, you might say something incorrectly and your reputation falls to pieces, but no matter what else happens, your dog is still going to be there.
So true.
So true.
What about histories written by the victors?
Well, that was in a speech later in his career, and he was reflecting on the fact that he was a Democrat following the Civil War. Most of his 24 years in the United States Senate, he was in the minority. And so, you know, when things were written about things that had happened, some of the things that they felt like they had done and they had accomplished were not reflected because they were not on the winning side. A lot of the credit for Yellowstone goes to different people than it does to him because they were on the larger side and he was on the smaller side. The part about that I mentioned about being fishing buddies was he took Chester Arthur to Yellowstone. They spent 3 weeks touring the park and fishing together, and he and Sheridan, General Sheridan, who was a Union general, the two of them, Vest and Sheridan, said, you know, the only way we're going to get this legislation passed is we have to have the president on our side. So they took the president to the park, spent 3 weeks with him, showing him how great it was. And that is where the legislation eventually came from to save Yellowstone.
Hmm. Okay. Well, you know, you're walking around with this book in your head and all this history in your head today in 2025 mm-hmm. with all that's going on. And I'm just wondering, given that context that you have, are there any lessons for today that could be taken from your account of the life of George Graham Vest?
Well, we're kind of in a situation like they were. There was one side and there was another side. There was very little middle ground for anybody. And they really could have benefited from some of the ideas of the other side modified either way. You know, if you're looking right or you're looking left, some of those ideas in the middle really could have benefited people, but they were so determined on having their way and it being their way or the highway that a lot of things didn't get done. And, you know, he wasn't the most progressive guy in the world, you know, in some of his ideas and thoughts. He was not a big proponent of voting rights for women, not because he didn't think they were worthy, but in his mind, they were above that. That politics was a dirty, nasty business, and women didn't need to be a part of something so foul and disgusting as politics, that they were better than that. So it's kind of a different twist, but in some of those things, he held on to some notions that were long gone that probably should have been abandoned, but he didn't. The one thing that I was really pleased with was his views on race. His family did have some enslaved persons when he was growing up. Most of those people stayed in his life after the war, long after the war. When his nanny died, the only person in his father's will outside of the immediate family that's mentioned in the will is this enslaved woman, Maria, who lived with the family. And then when she died, she's buried in the Frankfort Cemetery, which at that time was a restricted cemetery. Her tombstone is bigger than Mr. or Mrs. Vest, his parents' tombstones. And it says on the tombstone, "To my nurse and my friend," Maria Fenwick was her name, and then has his name signed underneath it. And in the 1870s, 1880s, you wouldn't call somebody a friend that wasn't your friend.
Well, it is quite an amazing story you've got here, Steve.
Well, thank you.
And I just wonder, how has this work informed your perspective about Kentucky history?
Well, as an example, we found ourselves on the wrong side many times ourselves, even when we were in the right. The Civil War is one example. Two-thirds of the people that fought in the Civil War from Kentucky fought for the North. The North won. So then we aligned ourselves with the South afterwards, which wasn't to our benefit. It didn't help us in any way. And in that case, we were on the winning side, and we chose to take up allegiance with the losing side. You know, and there's other things we do like that where we kind of let ourselves get in the way. And, you know, we value connections. That's one of the things we write about in Kentucky Monthly quite a bit. I think of Kentucky as one big, huge, small town. Mm-hmm. We're one large dysfunctional family. And this plays out in the book because, you know, George went to school here all the way through school, but in every stop of his life afterwards, he's surrounded by Kentuckians, most of whom he had known most of his life in other places. When he made it to the Senate, the chaplain of the Senate was the pastor from the First Presbyterian Church of Frankfort when he had been a member there. You know, so wherever he went, he was surrounded by people that he knew, and he valued those friendships.
I have a feeling that a lot of people who are hearing this are going to want to read this book.
Well, thank you.
Where can they find it?
You can pretty much get it anywhere books are sold, or you can go to KentuckyMonthly.com. It's available through our website, And also, anytime there's a book fair or a festival or something like that, you can usually find me.
Okay. Kentucky Monthly publisher Steve Vest, author of George Graham Vest, The Life and Times of Dog's Best Friend. It's published by Acclaim Press. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you for having me.
We're dog and cat people here at Eastern Standard, and since we're often puzzled by the way our four-legged friends behave, we figured you would be too. So we have a monthly series going, posing listener questions to dog and cat cognition researchers Ellen Furlong and Rebecca Singer. Ellen does her work at Transylvania University, and this month's question goes to her. From Amy Fisher, we have this question. What is it about the mailman or anybody in uniform, a perfectly behaved dog, becomes ridiculously aggressive? What's going on there?
Yeah, I think, you know, the mailman comes to your house every single day and tries to break in and then is thwarted in their attempts and they go away and then they come back again tomorrow. So I think if we think about the mailman from the dog's perspective, they could be potentially threatening. So that seems to be one reason why dogs are concerned about the mailman visiting. My dog, Olive, absolutely adores our mail carrier, Laura. but our mailbox is set up differently, so she's not coming to the door every day. And I think people in uniform just look different than average people, right, who are not in uniform. They might be wearing a hat. Hats can be scary for some dogs. They might be carrying weird equipment, like a mail bag, or, you know, if a police officer might have a walkie-talkie, right? There are lots of things that they might have that a person who's not in uniform doesn't have, and that can be new, and sometimes dogs are kind of freaked out by things that they haven't encountered before.
That's Transylvania University dog cognition researcher Ellen Furlong. Next month, we'll run a question by Berea College cat cognition researcher Rebecca Singer. And if you have a question, email it to us at es@eku.edu. Just write dog or cat in the subject line. Thanks for joining us. And a note here, the initial weekly broadcast of Eastern Standard will move to 1 p.m. as of April 3rd. Rebroadcasts will continue at 8 p.m. on Thursdays and 6 p.m. on Sundays. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at eswku.org, where you can check out our archive, our series, our partners, and sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin, and thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.